Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Wilsh, your host. And hey, look, I've got a, what would this show be? Someone wrote something a while back in YouTube, and I actually kind of laughed out loud, as they say, when I read it. And they said, what would we do if you didn't have technical problems? You know, we're so used to it. So anyway, I bought what's considered the top of the line studio camera for doing these streams. It's a Logitech C920. Automatic everything on the thing. And anyway, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see that I'm flickering. Isn't that nice, huh? But anyway, we'll get that straightened out by next week. I'm sure of it. At least it's not an audio issue. My guest tonight is Jonathan Lace. He's got a very interesting background. He was in the Air Force. We're going to talk about his background and what got him interested in the UFO topic. The blog over at Podcast UFO This Week is a Wyoming elk hunter takes a ride in a UFO. And that's about a story back in, I think, in the 1960s, I think it was. Actually, it's 1974. Check out the story. It's a real fun, another bizarre one. Charles Lear comes up with these great stories from the past. And so a great read. And he had a lot of help from Dave Marler on this one with some original documents. All right, so I'm not going to get used to the flickering, but I'm going to be bringing in our guest in just a second, and I'll have him take over the screen so you don't have to watch this. But I also want to say that if you check out our Facebook page, there's 20-some-odd thousand people over there. It's pretty active. And besides the blog, I do want to thank everyone that supports the show, and we've got some great new supporters this week. I want to give a little shout-out. Thank you so much, everyone. Supporting the show. I couldn't do it without you. And anyone can support the show. It's over, the link's over at our podcastufo.com website. And to get me flickering out of here, I'm going to bring in our guest. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Martin. Thanks so much for having me.
Yes. Jonathan, if you could, you have a real interesting background. And let's hear about that. Because you served in the Air Force. And but if you would give your background, if you would, and how you get interested in the UFO topic.
Sure. Thanks. So I grew up in the Deep South. I grew up in the Delta region of Arkansas, and I entered the Air Force right out of high school. I served in the United States Strategic Command, which was a joint unified command in Omaha, Nebraska. And we were the backup to NORAD, North American Aerospace Defense Command, and served there. When I left, I went into college, went to the University of Arkansas at Fayetteville, studied philosophy there. And then I left and went to, after I graduated, I went to Emory University in Atlanta and pursued something I'd always been interested in, which was theological studies. And graduated there, in 2003. And then I moved to New Jersey in 2006. I've been here ever since. And I currently teach computer science and iPhone app development at a local private school here in New Jersey. Now, when I was in the Air Force, I was a computer systems operator. We ran IBM 9000 mainframes. And if you've ever seen the movie Clear and Present Danger, there's one scene in which Jack Ryan, played by Harrison Ford, is in the CIA talking to an analyst. And behind him, you can see this rotating arm in like this silo grabbing data tapes. That's what we worked with. We actually built one of those when I was there.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. And so what got you interested? I know you're the public relations officer. I believe that's your title. To the SCU, and I do want to talk about that program. But what? How did you make the I don't want to say the leap, but you know, what made you kind of get a strong enough interest in this to do something actually publicly? Because that's what it is.
Sure. Yeah. Great question. So when I was a kid, I had a love for aerospace and the space program. You know, I remember going to space camp when I was 14 years old.
Oh, wow.
Just having in Huntsville, Alabama, and just having the time of my life. I want to give a shout out to Rich Hoffman. who's on the board of the SEU. He's from Huntsville. But I went to space camp, loved it. For various reasons, I didn't pursue that. One reason was because when I was in 10th grade, I realized I had to have glasses and corrected vision. And at the time, no branch of the military service was accepting pilots with corrected vision. That has since changed, but it wasn't at the time. So I didn't pursue that. And my whole life, I've been interested in flying in aerospace, et cetera. And I remember as a teenager hearing stories and starting to hear stories in the news and reading various books about people who had reported seeing things that they could not explain. And that was always just fascinating to me because I guess somewhere in the back of my mind, I was thinking, you know, if our country can put a man on the moon, surely we would be able to identify things that were terrestrial. So I read various books, sort of kept my finger on the pulse of goings on in the UFO world, so to speak. I remember there was a lot of buzz about a particular clip from the shuttle Discovery on one of its missions showing what reported to be, you know, a UAP or a UFO that was making a series of erratic movements in orbit around the Earth. To make a long story short, I paid tacit attention to headlines involving UFOs or things that people were reporting to be UFOs for all of my adult life. But I have to tell you that it was the 2004 and subsequent encounters, I believe in 2015, that were documented by the New York Times that occurred with the carrier group Nimitz in 2004, and I believe the Theodore Roosevelt
in
2015.
Florida, yeah.
Yeah, and those incidents, those stories, were very, very compelling for me. And what was particularly compelling was not only the eyewitness testimony of David Fravor and other eyewitnesses to the events, but what was compelling for me was a statement by the Defense Department, which basically admitted that our government really did not have any idea what these objects were. It does not serve our national interest to make such a statement if it's not the truth.
Yeah.
And, you know, from a national security perspective, if these objects are not otherworldly or not of, you know, extraterrestrial origin, then our country should be very, very concerned, because that would mean that, you know, potential adversaries have technology that can just run circles around us.
Right.
So when all that was starting to come out in the news, I really, really started to pay attention. I thought, you know, it's people who report UFOs, I know that, you know, for various reasons, many people in the field of ufology, right, kind of conflate claims. In other words, they will take a legitimate claim that something or some object has no plausible, terrestrial explanation or no current scientific explanation. And sometimes I think people have a tendency to conflate that with more extravagant claims involving more paranormal activity. And to sift through that can sometimes be a little difficult, because if you're a member of the general public, for example, and all you know about UFOs is that, only crazy people or crackpots, you know, report them or research them, et cetera, then you may have a tendency to sort of shy away from the topic altogether and sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater. But when the New York Times, Leslie Keene and her team did the reporting on the Nimitz and then the Theodore Roosevelt encounters, and then the statement by the Department of Defense, that really grabbed my attention in a very, very compelling way. And I thought, well, you know, this sort of elevates the conversation quite a bit. And it can't be just, you know, people that are, you know, on the fringe or people that are somewhat crazy or crackpots that are that are seeing these things. We now have trained military pilots who are reporting this, and we have official statements by the Department of Defense. So all that to say, I came to the conclusion that there is definitely something that is occurring in our skies and in some cases our oceans that defy explanation. And I just found that, you know, as a mystery to be extremely compelling. So I wanted to reach out and look for organizations that approach the phenomenon from a scientific perspective, because that's, you know, that's something that I identify with. I'm not a formal scientist by training, but I definitely respect the discipline, sort of the hard sciences, even though a lot of people don't consider computer science to be a real science. I certainly respect the scientific method. And so when I started looking for organizations that were devoted to, you know, very high scientific standards of analysis and evidentiary based claims, there was really only one organization that I discovered that met that criteria, and that was the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. And so I reached out and I applied to become a member and was accepted. And then, I started, pursuing some writing for the SCU and actually had a project proposal for the SCU. And I found a community of scientists that are fascinated by the unknown and are dedicated to the rigors of science to help answer that question.
Yes, I'm very impressed with them. I actually help behind the scenes quite a bit when they do their streams. Now, I want to pop this question up because this is something I hear quite a bit. And David is saying that Mike Barra, I've heard the name, but I'm not sure who that is, say they were drones. And I want to argue that point. Now, I do think it is possible that what was called the go fast of the three videos and a lock on that there is some possibility that might have been some type of high speed drone. I mean, I can give out of all three of them that, but here's the thing, the Navy, when they officially release them, they're saying that they don't know what they are.
Right.
And if they're going to say that, they're not going to make a fool out of themselves by not really looking into the possibilities of what these things could be. So I'm hearing a lot of that. Someone wrote a comment the other day that Mark D'Antonio, who's actually a friend, and I got to get a hold of him, has claimed that he's solved all the three videos. But and he is a photo and video analyst for MUFON. But again, I got to give him a call and find out if that's really a true comment and he really is claiming to. And if so, I got to find out what he's saying about them. Because when it goes to the Tic Tac itself, the one off the coast of San Diego, Catalina, or wherever it was out there, with all the different methods of data that they got for those particular objects, whatever they were, you know, because you're involved with the SCU and some of the, you know, research they've done, as far as it doesn't fit into what we know of physics, of how these things could do what they did and stay in one piece and even have that type of propulsion with the no heat and no, you know, I mean, there's so many things that didn't make sense that it just would be, I think it's impossible for the Tic Tac to be any type of drone. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. And what are your general thoughts on that one in particular?
Yeah, I've certainly seen that theory that it was a drone. I've seen another theory. This was published in Forbes magazine, that it was a laser induced plasma filament, basically a three-dimensional laser projection. When I listened to the description of the encounter by David Fravor and other witnesses like PJ Hughes, and others who were part of that entire encounter, especially on the Nimitz in 2004, their descriptions do not match, you know, any known technology of drones that I'm aware of. I'm not saying it's not, but I'm just saying, you know, it doesn't seem to be consistent with what we know about drone technology today.
Let me ask you this. You said that one of the theories is it's laser induced plasma. I believe you said something like that.
Yes.
Would that show up on radar?
It would show up on radar. And of course, we don't have access to the radar. I'm not an expert on this by any means, but the very brief research that I've done on that particular hypothesis is that there's no kind of technology that could replicate all the flight characteristics and all the EM characteristics that have been described and that were observed by the eyewitnesses of the alleged incident, that would be consistent with any sort of, you know, laser-induced 3D object.
Right, right. And
excuse me.
As far as I want to get back to the subject about science and UFOs. Mm-hmm. When you first looked into, hey, you know, is anyone that has some type of science background taking this seriously? Mm. Was it, were you frustrated or did you find the SCU quite quickly?
I actually found them quite quickly, and I found them amidst of, you know, some other organizations, maybe that had been around for a little bit longer, excuse me. And, it was really important for me, you know, to associate with an organization that was devoted to a very conservative, rigorous approach to science, one that would not be making unwarranted or, you know, extraordinary claims without a correspondent level of extraordinary proof. And I found SCU rather quickly. And, you know, it was important for me not only as a citizen, but also, as you said, you know, I mean, this is a very public role that I eventually assumed for the SCU. And as someone who serves in local government, right, there's definitely a stigma attached to the UFO/UAP phenomenon in the public. But that's particularly the case, I think, with people who serve in official capacities. And even though, you know, being a member of the local borough council is not a huge, you know, it's not like being the governor of Arizona or it's not like being the president of the United States. And we know that there have been claims of UFOs from, you know, from those levels of government. There is a stigma attached to it. And, you know, I mean, quite frankly, you know, when you reached out for our show tonight, you know, there was a little second thought in the back of my head, you know, do you really want to be that public with, you know, talking openly about your interest and your fascination with this topic? But I do believe that, you know, there are probably a lot of people like me that are out there at large. I tend to call them the pro science public. They may not be scientists by formal training, but they, you know, they remember the scientific method from high school. They understand its value. They trust in scientific institutions and they know the value of science, and they've seen the contributions of science, you know, over the years. And so for me, it's really important that the SCU not only engage with academia, but also that the SCU be really a voice for that segment of the population, what I call the pro-science public.
Yeah, I was wondering what I had heard that term, pro-science public. And you think there's going to be all along, there's just going to be great, like, relations between the public and transparency with all the reporting? It's all going to be available for anyone to come and take a look?
Well, I can tell you all the formal work that the SCU does is certainly open for peer review, and our reports are published on our website, and that's explorescu.org.
And has anyone peer reviewed anything as of yet? Do you know?
I don't know of any other institutions that have. I do know the invitation is always open, and I do know that there are multiple people within the SCU that have put their names on reports. I will say this. I believe that I want to say Robert Powell, Kevin Newth, and I think one, maybe Peter Reale did a piece that was published in a peer-reviewed journal. I confess I don't remember the name of it right now off the top of my head, but it is on our website, and it was a journal devoted to, I want to say thermodynamics, but that might not be accurate. But that to say that our members have published in peer-reviewed journals in the larger scientific community.
Well, I think, well, let me just ask you this. Do you think that if enough scientists get involved with this topic, that there could be some breakthroughs eventually? I mean, are you optimistic about that?
Yeah. So one of our goals, you know, is to reach out to academia, and that's really important for, I think, the future of sort of the conversation at large. You know, we provide services that are all listed on our website. We want to have dialogue with the larger scientific community. And I do think now that what I call a post-Nimitz, UFO conversation publicly, I do think that more and more scientists will look at statements from the Department of Defense and say, you know, wow, that's quite a remarkable statement. I don't know how much on the radar this issue is with scientists in general around the world, but I will say this, that, you know, speaking about this post 2004 is now a very much a different context than it was pre 2004, before these disclosures by the New York Times, before these videos published by the Department of Defense, and before the statement by the DOD.
Right. I'm just going to I'm just showing up here on the screen. Just a couple of things for people on YouTube. They can see that, there's a lot to dig around on this website. And have you looked into the new website called The Debrief? Have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, I've been there a couple of times. I want to say about maybe 3 weeks to a month ago now, they published a big story about, a photograph taken from what looked to be an F-18 Hornet. Yeah. I forget the year. Of an object and supposedly another photo that has yet to be published.
Right. That's a 2019 photo.
Yeah. Involving a craft coming up from the ocean. Yeah. So I'm familiar with the website. Yeah.
Yeah. That would now if something like that. I had heard about this and I was told to keep it quiet for, I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 months ahead of time that there was that photo of the triangle craft coming out of the ocean caught by a F-18 Hornet pilot, and that it was going viral within the defense community, and so I'm surprised it hasn't leaked actually. And another thing, I was contacted by a gentleman that listens to the show, retired Navy, and he's saying that well, maybe I should try to find his email, but he's basically saying that it's really taboo to have your iPhone, your cell phone in a cockpit because of tracking situations. It's not acceptable. And I'm wondering what the implications of that would be.
Gosh, yeah, I don't know. I don't know the current policy in the Department of Defense about having smartphones on operational missions. I do know that it occurs because the New York Times ran a story on this very issue. I want to say last year, maybe the year before. And the story was about how, various military personnel who may be on deployment or on a mission you know, if they have certain settings on their smartphone turned on, then that data can be aggregated, and you can, you know, if you have access to the data, you can track the movements of, you know, of military personnel around the world, which would be a huge, huge operational security concern.
Right.
So, you know, presumably an article like that would not have been written if it wasn't something that was already happening.
I see.
So I don't know the current policy, but I do know, you know, I mean, I would infer from an article like that, that it has occurred certainly in the past.
Hmm. Now, let me just ask you this. So do you, freely talk about the UFO topic to friends and, you know, other colleagues and people out there?
Yeah, great question. I talk about it with people that I believe might have an interest in it.
You try to feel them out to see if they'll...
To an extent. I mean, like I said, there is still, I think, a significant stigma attached to it. And, you know, I don't, you know, randomly interject that I, you know, happen to volunteer for this nonprofit that studies the UFO phenomenon. But yeah, I mean, you know, I certainly raise it with people that I think, you know, might be interested. I will tell you one segue that I have found to raise the topic that's particularly interesting is astronomy.
Yes.
You know, I've been a fan of the space program since I was a kid. And now that we have, you know, phones that can tell us exactly when, you know, the International Space Station is going to be flying over our homes. Mm-hmm. You know, I bought a pair of astronomy binoculars last year and, you know, would go out and would look at, you know, Jupiter and Venus, and, you know, to see the moons around Jupiter for the first time through, you know, with your own eyes is quite a moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
And to see the space station fly over, you know, your house, with a magnitude of like, you know, -4.0, it's brilliant in the sky. And I think if you are a person who values, you know, scientific progress in the space program, and you find people around you or in your neighborhood that also value that, I do think there are opportunities to discuss things that, you know, some people may consider rather taboo, or some people themselves may be a little reluctant to discuss. So again, yeah, I talk about it with people that I believe might have an interest in it.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. I kind of do too. You know, I'm reluctant to, I mean, I've had a number of people that I'm in the fine arts and antiques and appraiser, and I'm fairly well known for that type of work. And I've had a few other people across the country call me and tell me, "Oh my God, I can't believe you're into this." And then they tell me about a sighting and that they had, and, you know, why they're interested in it. And I'm going to say that's been about four different people in the that are actually antique dealers, or one was on TV. That was pretty interesting. And anyway, it's really interesting, and it really, you can get a feel. I've figured it out. You can get a feel about how someone reacts to one question, whether they're going to be open to it.
Yeah.
Like for instance, when the Navy came out and said that, you know, they, about those, when they were talking about those videos, I was at a retired Navy, a young retired Navy gentleman's house. And I said, "Hey, did you see that about, you know, the Navy releasing UFOs?" He goes, "Yeah, I've been following that." And then I feel comfortable talking to someone about it. Mm-hmm. But you have to, you know, someone has to be kind of open the door a little bit. Otherwise, you know, you can get the feeling of the taboo. You know, when I'm there appraising fine art and I talk about UFOs, they might say, "Get out of here."
Yeah, yeah, that's what I found. I mean, you know, the fact that it's in a major publication like the New York Times, or it's in a statement released by the Department of Defense, I mean, that certainly provides, you know, a level of credibility to start discussing the issue, I think, with people who might be interested in ways that just weren't possible before. So, you know, for example, if you have friends who, you know, are regular readers of the news, you know, you might say, hey, did you see the article in the New York Times about this or that? Or did you, you know, if you have friends in the military, did you see the statement that the Department of Defense released, you know, which again, I think speaks to the fact that we are now living in a different kind of, a different context in, you know, what I call a post-Nimitz, you know, UFO discussion.
I think that's a great, I think that's a great term. Because nothing else, well, it's actually, I've said a number of times, it's post New York Times, you know, December 16, 2017 article, you know, when that came out, even though it was that exact same topic was totally discussed by, you know, To the Stars and Tom DeLonge, on a video, I watched the live stream video back in the October ahead of that. Mm-hmm. It didn't really change anything, but once that came out, yeah, the front page of the New York Times, it changed everything.
Yeah. You know, again, it's the conversations that are happening today, and I would say that the level of engagement and the walks of life of people that are, you know, becoming interested in this topic is certainly a very different pool than what would have existed, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I'm opening the phone lines. I know this is a, you know, just a 1 hour show here. So if anyone has a question for our guest tonight, please call in. That number is 855-472-5483. And Bill will be standing by. And I'm just putting it up here. And as far as the DOD, mm-hmm, do you think, or as far as the government in general, do you feel as though they may just soften up to this topic and let it out there more, you know, because it seems more credible than it did, you know, 3 years ago, like you mentioned?
Yeah. That's a good question. You know, my sort of gut instinct is that, you know, the Department of Defense will not say anything unless there is, you know, a compelling reason for them to make a statement. I feel as if that I believe it was April of last year when the Department of Defense made their, you know, admission that, you know, we don't know what these objects are. In some ways, I believe that statement sort of had to be made because they had authorized the release of the videos. So it's hard for me to have a, you know, it's hard for me to make a prediction about, you know, how open they're going to be in the future. Mm-hmm. I will say this, that having spoken to some of the witnesses of the Nimitz encounter, that they have told me that their former shipmates, some of whom they did not know necessarily or were friends with on the ship, or ships, I should say, have started to come forward and talk to them. So I do think that, the more attention, you know, the more daylight that this issue is given, the more likely it is that, you know, the Department of Defense and our government will have to, you know, have to respond to that. Mm-hmm. It's just hard to predict, you know, to what degree or the reasons why.
Yeah, you know, I've said many times, you know, that if they do not have any idea what they are, it's almost to their benefit for them to sweep it under the rug and mm-hmm. to, you know, do what they've been doing for the last 70 years. Because they have no, if, you know, they have no control over what's in our skies, it could be scary to a lot of people.
Yeah. As I said earlier, you know, if it's not otherworldly craft that we're dealing with here, then, you know, we have some major worries.
Right.
You know, because that means potential adversaries have access to technology that is, you know, running circles around professionally trained, you know, top-notch pilots. And right. That's it was worrying to, if you ever listened to, David Fravor speak about this.
Yeah.
He basically says the same thing that, you know, if it's not otherworldly, then, you know, our nation has cause to be concerned.
Yeah, absolutely. We have Luis on from L.A. on the line. Luis, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Martin, for having me, as always. Awesome. Yeah. As always, thanks for having this guest on. My question for Mr. Lace, thank you for coming on, by the way. I really appreciate your perspective and all of this. I'm a big fan of Occam's Razor, and I think Occam's Razor on this topic is something along the lines of humans have figured out a exotic form of propulsion. Our military somehow has figured out something just crazy, and they don't know how to apply it yet. Similar to, you know, the F-117 Nighthawk. That thing was doing bombing missions in 1981. It wasn't publicly introduced, I believe, until 1988. So could we just be dealing with something that is built by human hands? Because I don't put it past human ingenuity to create something like this, but we just haven't figured out how to release it into society. Michio Kaku says that, you know, as humans, we'll have the ability to create matter within the next 20 years, a machine that creates matter. But the problem with a machine like that is that you can't apply it to society and just throw it into everyday society and say, okay, good luck with the matter making machine. You know, it would take 100 years before you ever saw that machine sold to the public for, you know, whatever reason. You know, if you want to type in football, it will give you a football. And we can see that coming with 3D printing, and pre-seen 3D printers will be printing organs. So I guess, you know, long story short, what are the odds that what we're dealing with here is something man-made, something that just is so top secret that it is out of the realm of maybe even military hands, and it is securely faceted to the private sector? I know that's a loaded question. There's a lot going on there, but if you can answer it the best way you can, and I know it's speculation as well. So, you know, I'm speculating, of course, as well. That's just kind of my theory, but I'd like to hear what you think about that. And I'll hang up and let them. Thank you again, Jonathan and Martin. You guys rule.
You bet. Thanks, Luis.
Yeah, Luis. Gosh, great question. One that I've had myself many, many times, and to some extent still do. I guess the short answer is, I mean, also having an affinity for Occam's Razor. I guess the short answer is, you know, I guess it is possible. I don't want to get into degree of probability, with regard to that. But I think it's important to have an open mind, right, and not to make any unwarranted claims or preordained conclusions about this question. If it is something that we have produced, I'll just say this, it's remarkable that it's been kept secret the way that it has, presumably for so long, at least since 2004. And if it is something that we have created, it has the potential to change, you know, almost every facet of our daily life as we know it. And, disclosure and deserves to be, treated with kid gloves as it's sort of slowly rolled out into society. It is definitely a possibility. And again, if it's not otherworldly, right, if it is something that is terrestrial, then that technology could also be displayed or fall into the hands of, you know, people that have adverse intentions against the United States. And I know from a national security perspective, I think that's what has motivated people like Senator Marco Rubio, who, to his credit, you know, has raised this issue in official proceedings of the Senate. Great question. And I share I don't want to say belief that it is probably man-made, but I certainly hold that possibility open. I think it's really important. I was just going to say, I think it's really important to, you know, especially in a case, in a situation like this, to reserve judgment, instead of making statements about what, you know, people, you know, claim that it is, it's probably safer to proceed and rule out what we know it not to be. So,
well, my thoughts are, why would they release it when it could have an encounter with a military exercise? Why would they do that? And, you know, you may say, well, maybe to see how the reaction would be, but there could have been a very bad reaction. You know, there could have been, well, actually, they weren't hot. They didn't have, I don't think they had any weapons aboard. I believe they didn't during exercise. But still, they could have, you know, they could have thought this thing was a major threat. And, you know, I just wonder what went on behind the scenes. Like, did someone talk to someone in upper, you know, in the upper government to say, hey, do you know what's going on? And did they know? You know, I mean, I guess that's where the answers would lie. I don't know.
Yeah, especially when we have, you know, statements from the alleged eyewitnesses who claim that. And by the way, when I say alleged eyewitnesses, I'm not saying I don't believe their story. I'm just saying that, you know, I wasn't there, you know, you weren't there. So I'm just trying to treat it, you know, with a bit of epistemic humility, as it were. But, you know, statements from the alleged eyewitnesses claim that within minutes, right, after this encounter, especially in 2004, you know, there were Air Force personnel, I believe,
right.
Air Force personnel on the ship. You know, who no doubt knew about it. I'm sure they were probably monitoring it from California. And so then that raises the question, right? I mean, were they monitoring it because they knew it was going to happen, and which would sort of lend credence to the hypothesis that it really is sort of, you know, our technology being deployed? Or did they, you know, happen to see it, or, you know, and get alerted to it?
And why would they take the bricks, you know, the data bricks?
Right.
Well, I mean, I guess you could argue they would take it to see how it showed up on the radar and things like that. Let's see. We have another caller. We have Steve calling from Oregon. Welcome to the show, Steve. Hello, Steve. You there? Bill, I'm not sure what's going on.
I have him on the line, on the air, but
hey guys, can you hear me okay?
There he is.
All right. Hey, welcome to the show, Steve.
You hear me okay?
Yep. Go ahead. You're live. Steve, you have a question for our guest?
Can you hear me okay, Bill?
I don't think he's hearing us, Bill. So I'm going to drop that. So we'll
okay. Okay, so you got me now?
Yeah.
I do have a
quick question. Go ahead. Let's hear your question. All right. We're going to move on. I'm sorry about that. I'm not sure what the issue was with that. But, it's something to certainly ponder as far as, you know, what these things are. And yeah, there's always, I mean, we should look at everything with a skeptic's eye to try to figure out what it is. And, you know, kind of by process of elimination, that's kind of what they do with the, you know, UFO reports. You know, could have been Venus? Could it have been, you know, hot air balloon? What was going on in the sky at that time? Like you said, the International Space Station, was that flying over? You know, all these questions to eliminate everything it is. But when it comes to those encounters, it's awful hard to eliminate a lot of things.
Yeah. I want to revisit something I mentioned earlier. You had asked about the possibility that it's a laser induced plasma filament, right? Which was a hypothesis put forward in Forbes magazine. I want to just correct something I think I said. I'm pretty sure that in the research that I did on this, that it would not have been visible on radar if it were indeed a 3D, you know, projected image. I actually wrote an article on this in the SCU Review, And those are newsletters that primarily circulate to our membership, but then later are released to the public. And those are all located on the on our website, exploresu.org. So if you click on research blog, research and publications blog, you can find the SCU review. You can also find links to our larger studies involving, for example, the Nimitz report. I think our Nimitz report is something on the order of 270 pages long.
Wow.
There's also a report on the 2013 Aguadilla.
I love that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have, we're going to try Steve again. We have someone else on the line too. Steve, let's give you another try. Are you there?
Yeah. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you now. Yeah. You better blurt your question while you have a chance.
Okay. All right. So my question is this. So you're out in this carrier group and you come across this thing that's flying circles around the best of the best. Why don't you stop what you're doing? Why don't you stop what you're doing and just keep investigating? Because the one thing you would need to investigate is a carrier group, because you're 125 or whatever, however many hundreds of miles offshore. You would need a carrier group with planes that could investigate. And that's where I have problems with this story. It just doesn't make sense that they wouldn't have called back to the Pentagon and said, hey, we got something flying circles around the best of the best. What do you want us to do? But all the people Martin had on his show who were on the carrier group, the radar people and that PJ guy, they said they just continued on with the exercises.
And yeah, that is strange.
To me, that just doesn't sound credible. There's something wrong about that.
Yep. Unless they knew it was going to happen, you know, which is another thing, that could point.
What fits the bill for this is like Skunk Works and some super advanced drone, like, you know, maybe some kind of energy cell drone, and the tic tac that they were seeing was just like the outside shroud of a drone, and they couldn't really tell what was happening inside. You know, they couldn't see, you know, any kind of propulsion system inside. Clearly it wasn't, you know, like petroleum. It wasn't, Steve, you know, because there was no heat signature.
Right. So Steve, I don't know if you want to chime in with anything, but my thought is, why would the Navy then say that was one of the three released videos that they had no idea what it is? Do you think if it was something from Skunk Works that they're just playing the game?
So what about this? What about they're looking at drone footage that and stuff that they've been sent and stuff that they encountered, and they just don't know what it is? And what they're really saying is, we just don't know what that is. But they're not suggesting in any way, shape, or form that it's otherworldly.
That's true.
They probably think it's, you know, some sort of drone. They just don't know whose it is or how they made it.
Yeah. Any comment on that?
Gosh, no. I mean, without knowing, without knowing operational procedures or policies of the U.S. Navy, it would be hard for me to speak to that. I mean, those are all, I suppose, valid questions, but I'm pretty sure if Commander Fravor were here, he would have a really good response to that. So I don't want to speculate on that really at all. I don't know.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call, Steve.
All right. Thanks. See you guys.
I didn't mean to cut you off. Did you have a final word? Oh, he's gone.
Yeah.
All right. So we have Andy from Connecticut. Frequent flyer, Andy, how you doing?
Hi, yes, good to talk again. Hey, yeah. I have a kind of a multi-part question for the guests. Firstly, is his group planning on only reacting to or responding to events in the UFO field as they occur, or are they addressing other big cases in the recent past, like O'Hare or the JAL airlines over Alaska, and so on? And then also, Do they have any thoughts on whether the phenomenon is interdimensional or intergalactic or something else based on the flight characteristics and, you know, all the eyewitness testimony and the radar recordings? Mm-hmm. And then lastly, you know, what do they think going forward? Do they have a plan in place to bring the media and you know, popular culture on board with what might really be happening, given the history going, you know, back thousands of years with the, where, you know, TV shows like Ancient Aliens and things are kind of taking the subject.
Right. Well, just keep in mind, we have 4 minutes, a lot to unpack in 4 minutes there.
Right. Yeah. Thank you so much, Andy, for the question. So to the first question, you know, the SCU will investigate any claims of UAP or UFO activity for which there's a sufficient amount of data to make a scientific analysis. You know, when you have, you know, a case that's primarily based on eyewitness testimony without any sort of other kind of testimony, that really kind of limits, you know, the kind of scientific analysis that can be done. You know, scientific analysis requires objective data. And, you know, to the extent that a case or an incident has that, I think, you know, the SCU has a compelling interest in looking at that. That applies to cases that, you know, might be, you know, come to light tomorrow. That applies to, you know, cases like the Nimitz encounter, you know, Aguadilla, et cetera. So I would say that, you know, any case for which there is a sufficient amount of data for objective scientific analysis, the SCU would be interested in. Could you tell me again your second question very quickly? Sorry.
He's hung up.
Okay. I think one of his other two questions was, you know, to what extent is the SCU engaging with the larger culture? I can tell you that, you know, SCU, we get media requests on a fairly regular basis. And, you know, we respond to those requests, and we want to be very careful that we lend our name and that of our organization to projects that we believe meet the standards that we have for ourselves. So there are, I think, you know, it's fair to say that there is a lot of interest in this topic now in the media versus from what there may have been prior to December 16th, 2017. And I think that the future will, you know, hold some very promising work for the SCU, not only in, you know, scientific analysis of UAP claims, but also in our effort to engage and partner with other organizations that want to engage the larger public.
Just in the chat, Joe, sorry, we can't, we don't have time to answer your question, but a UFO will always be a UFO. The very name means unidentified. Yes, that's right. Once it's identified, it's an IFO, identified flying object or whatever aerial object, but IAO, whatever. Anyway, we are at the end of the show, so I want to thank you so much for your time tonight, and I really appreciate it. It was great. All right. All right. You take care now.
You too. Thanks, Martin.
All right. Thanks.